Hello and welcome to episode 25 of the Complimentary Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Katie Langerman, joined as always by Anthony Hobday. And today we're going to talk about things that we're not good at related to interface design, which is kind of an interesting topic, an interesting angle, I guess, to look at this from. This was your idea.
Yeah, I always find it a bit strange that I feel like this podcast is, maybe because it's just the two of us and I'm not the one hitting publish, but it doesn't feel like I'm talking to the world. Anyone could potentially go and download it or listen to it. It feels like I'm just talking to you. And so I think I'm more willing, just like with the hot takes episode over Christmas.
Yeah.
I'm more willing to talk about things that maybe I wouldn't talk about on social media, for example, where I might hesitate before I talked about things I'm not good at. But again, maybe that's just because it's like there's a chance to explain yourself in more depth.
Yes. There's just something about having that text permanently displayed on a website that anyone can see. I guess any logged in user can see. But podcasts are a little more, takes more work to listen to a podcast. But
yeah,
people are listening. But,
I have found that if you design things, then being aware of your limitations is a good thing, even if it's hard to admit to. Just because you might, I mean, in the past, in a general sense, I've noticed that, oh, I don't like this thing or I'm not good at this thing and I therefore avoid it. And maybe that's a good thing to be aware of if you want to improve or you want to be honest with your managers when they ask you to do something, or if you want to sort of put extra effort into your blind spots, essentially.
Yep.
So, yeah. It feels like good practice.
I feel similarly. For me, a lot of these are like, also things that I know I'm not good at, but I know that I can figure out if I need to, like when I need to figure them out. And so I just don't worry about being good at them all of the time. And when the time comes, I know I can learn it and figure out my way through, I guess. Just depends on what it is. Some things are, you need more like a broad skill set for than other things. So
yeah, and I agree with you completely, but it does sound like that line that's almost comedy these days in interviews where someone says, oh, I don't know that fundamental thing, but I'm a quick learner. And they're trying to convince the person to hire them, right? But, you know, yeah. Why don't they know this? But then I should, some of the things I've listed are quite fundamental. So I'll really need to, you know, go into some detail about what I mean. Otherwise, people are going to worry that I've been telling a lie this entire time.
I was surprised to see some of yours, but we'll get into it. Should we just jump right in then?
Yeah.
Start with my first one. Okay. So my first one is motion animation design. And we just talked about this recently, where I think I also said I'm not very good at it. And this is one that I think, like, I suppose there are some designers who specialize in this area and can just like jump right in. If we use CSS as an example and just do a bunch of animation with CSS and know exactly what each part of the animation means, like, because there's so many different aspects of it, which are all things that you can look up and figure out, like, by reading the spec. So it's like a pretty technical thing that I think anyone can learn, but there's definitely some more skill to it than like the basic stuff. And in my line of work, it's just something that I rarely really need. Like, I would maybe need to do a big deep dive into it to create a system of animation to be used in a design system, and then I would probably never think about it again. So like, that sounds like fun, but it's not something I can just do regularly and have like a lot of knowledge around, because it's just not something I'm reaching for. So I suppose my solution is to not use animations like 90% of the time.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I wonder, you mentioned the system of animations. I'm curious about if that's a different skill set again, because if you're creating a system of animations, are you offering these different variables that people can tweak? And so they're still the ones deciding what the easing curve looks like, for example.
Yeah, but you need to create a scale of some kind of like fast, and then you get to name it. Is it fast, faster, fastest, slow, slower, or like have very little, very few options that are just like, this is our transition for everything. and there is no flexibility. So like, it kind of depends, and that's where the research part comes in, I think, to for your product to figure out like what is it that we actually need, and then write documentation around how it's supposed to be used. So yeah, it's slightly different, less creative maybe.
Well, yeah, I mean, it feels good, I suppose, not to be the one who's having to decide what's the best version of this animation. But that's why I think I say it's a different skill set, because actually you're going and finding all of the possible things you might want to support. And then, like you say, you are setting sort of sensible default bounds, upper and lower.
Right.
Maybe you never want to offer a 3-second long screen transition, because that would be a nightmare. And so you've got to say, like, what's the longest that you ever want to offer and why?
Yeah.
So it's a bit more strategic, a bit more planning involved.
Yeah. And then it's also technical. I think animation design in particular is technical. I'm telling you right now, I'm not good at this. So I haven't really like gone in to learn all of the different tools, because I know there's so many tools now that will help you do this kind of thing. But like, then you have to figure out what is realistic and possible in code. And that's where the CSS part comes. And so I would find it hard to not focus on that and be like, well, I want to make sure I'm using the most best, newest, greatest CSS for all of these. So I like seem like I know what I'm doing here. So it would be both design and then also technical to make sure I'm like with the times, because these things are always changing. So yeah.
This is one of those situations where starting with the what's technically possible makes the most sense to me personally, and I'm sure to you as well. But I assume there are people who jump into, I think it's called After Effects, right? The Adobe Motion. I get mixed up between After Effects and whatever you use for film editing in the Adobe suite.
Yes. What is that?
So I'm not sure which one I'm talking about. But there's one that's like specifically, I think, focused on animation. And I think some people jump into that and like produce some really impressive stuff, but then can they have it built? Can they build it themselves? Can they have it built by someone else? Whereas I know that some designers, especially who work on websites, for example, start with the CSS and figure out, okay, like there's the new CSS, is it called View Transitions?
Yeah, that's everyone's an interesting one. About that,
because it means you can do a lot of these things a bit more easily than you could, which is, I mean, I'm probably going to be coping a lot with some of these, like with my responses about how we don't need to know this thing. But it feels like there are a few CSS properties you can learn about, and then you've got a pretty good starting point if you want to go and talk to a developer about, okay,
let's
build this, or if you want to do it yourself in your case.
Yeah, there's tons of stuff I want to learn about. I just have a hard time prioritizing things that I know are not super relevant to whatever task I'm doing at work, which that is something that has definitely shifted for me over the years in my career, because I think I used to be a bit more ambitious when I was younger and would just put tons of time into learning things on the side. And now I'd like to go, like, not be on the computer when I'm not working on work. So sorry, CSS animations. I'll learn you another day.
Well, it sort of makes sense to you as your career goes on longer, you learn more and more about what you want to do.
Yeah.
And I was the same way. I learned about everything I get my hands on, but I haven't used some of it. And so maybe I shouldn't have learned about it, but how would I have discovered what I wanted to do if I hadn't?
Exactly.
I suppose.
Right.
Yes. My first one is, I originally wrote layout, and I was like, okay, basically the three that I wrote down are the three
fundamentals
of visual design. which I don't want to. So I try to be a bit more specific. And so what I've written is expressive layout. And the reason I wrote that instead of layout is because actually I'm quite good at layout and I really enjoy exploring layouts. But I think about it in such an orderly way. And this is one of those cases where knowing how the web works, the box model and everything, sort of doesn't trip me up, but it limits my thinking a bit, because when I want to do a layout, often I'm thinking in very orderly ways where everything's a box and everything's sort of lined up in grids or, flex boxes or something, columns and rows. I don't often think about more expressive layouts where things are sort of breaking the rules, just because, especially if I have to build it myself, which I do sometimes, I don't really want to have to go and figure out the right CSS for that. Basically, anything that requires absolute positioning, I avoid like the plague, because it's scary and I don't like it.
I mean, you should be scared.
How does it responsive,
Yeah.
So anything expressive layouts, it takes me a little bit of a kickstart to jump out of that sort of rut I find myself in.
Yeah.
And so I like to stick to very orderly, systematic layouts because that's both the way I think and the way I've... at work, other people are building the things I design. And so I'm thinking about them. And for my own personal websites and other projects, I'm building it. So I've got this, preference for whatever simplest.
Right.
And, unexpressive, classical layouts can be extremely good looking, but it might take a bit more effort to impress people with them, which is also for a bit more cope. it's harder actually to make a really good design that doesn't use expressive layout and that will impress people.
Yeah, I can see that. When do you find expressive layout comes up as like a sticking point for you? What kind of work, like landing page?
I'm working on a website at the moment, sort of slowly, not necessarily just for fun, but I'm taking it slow because I don't want to throw too much time into it. But I'm doing some things there that make it a bit more expressive and therefore hopefully impress people who visit it a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And so is that sort of thing where you want to make an impact? Also landing pages, like at work, if I work on the app that I help design,
right,
then I'm going to be using much more sort of classical layout and orderly layout because we don't want things like tilted or shifting out of their column slightly or something, like columns that start at different heights, that sort of thing. Whereas the landing page itself, you want something that will keep people looking, keep people scrolling, and impress them when they turn up.
Mm.
Although in this case, I build the landing page at work myself in Webflow. So that's also been affected by my refusal to be a bit more expressive with my layouts. If I was just handing it off to someone else who was a landing page, building expert, I'd probably be a lot more inventive and make them cry a lot more.
Make them cry.
Yeah. Choices that make developers cry is sort of a good thing for designers.
I think I'm on the same page as you, but I am not afraid of complicated layouts, not in terms of like when we think about layout, like an entire page layout, but more really detailed component layouts, like something that needs a grid. I put a grid on everything. And I mean like a CSS grid, that kind of thing. I like those kinds of little challenges. It's like a puzzle to figure it out of like, how do I make this responsive? But I wouldn't call that expressive. That's just like, I refuse to be limited by the technology of something that I know is possible. Nothing crazy, nothing really out there, but just like, this should be possible. We can figure this out. So no tears.
I put Flexbox on everything that I code. I mean, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. The CSS you have to write to get equal gaps between items, but not above or below those items in a container, versus the CSS you have to write to get that with Flexbox is just night and day. You can just put the gap on. I shouldn't be talking about technical stuff in an interface design podcast.
I know. Well, now you just reminded me. I think that they are trying. I think there is a new property coming that will basically give us like the benefits of Flex without having to add Flex to everything. Maybe gap is one of them. I'm not sure, but we should be. This is not a CSS podcast.
That does ring a bell. And,
that's exciting.
That is nice of them. But
thank you. Okay, next one.
Yeah.
Me. So I wrote form over function. And this is just like, when I say form over function, I guess I mean, especially as a systems designer, I feel like sometimes I'm a little bit narrowly focused on the functionality and how to achieve that goal over the aesthetics sometimes. And I think I eventually get there, and I really love collaborating with designers who are like much more expressive, I guess, than I am. I'm like just like a very utilitarian, functional kind of designer. So I will often neglect kind of like the little I don't want to say I neglect the details because I love details, but I've had to put a lot of work into like getting there with detail. Like details for me are like different states and interactions, like hover and active and thinking through all of those things. Where I start to lose it a little bit is like shadows. Drop shadows are really hard for me. I basically need someone to tell me what to do. Like I need a library or a tool to tell me like this is the proper shadow. I often don't even notice shadows until I like look at the CSS and realize, oh, there's tons of stuff going on here. And my instinct is like, let's just get rid of it. I can't see it anyways. But then I have to remind myself, like, somebody put a lot of thought into this shadow and it's probably there for a reason. That's kind of an area that I struggle with, which is maybe okay. I don't know. It's something I want to keep getting better at, but there's not a ton of room for visual design on a established design system. It's pretty much just refining things. There's not a lot of new stuff that comes along. So,
yeah, it feels like the effects of function are so much more obvious to everyone. You know, if I click this button, does it work? Or in more subtle ways, you know, do I know what I should click next? Whereas form, I mean, if we're talking about form in terms of beauty, it feels like the effects of beauty are so much more subtle. And just because it's hard to talk about, I think it's hard to learn about.
Yeah.
Which is, I mentioned that partly because it sort of informed a lot of my career where I realized that was something that I was not as good at and could not learn as easily. And so I became obsessed with it. Which is interesting because unlike other things I'm not as good at and don't really care to learn more about until I need it, like animation.
Yeah.
Form of a function, I saw something in the power of form, I suppose, and thought I need to learn as much as I can about this. But I respect people who sort of ignore it a little in the sense that if I see like a really simple but functional website, I sort of really respect the person who took that chance, you know, even though they might not as impress people as much. They're focusing on how well it works, which is, I love
important.
That.
I think there's maybe some risk involved with focusing on form and you have to be willing to fail. You have to be open to designing something that makes no sense. Like you have to iterate a lot, I think, for it to eventually get to something that is both functional and beautiful. And it's easier to just skip that part and go straight to functional and like good enough. The beautiful side. So I respect people who are put themselves out there, I guess, in that way.
And maybe it's a similar point in that because we can sort of recognize the benefits of function or understand function a bit better, it does take less iteration or it is more obvious when it's gone right or gone wrong. And yeah, you don't have that certainty with form. Okay, my next one, I couldn't think of an adjective for this one, so I just left it as typography, which is the second of the three pillars. What I mean, though, is that I've learned, I think, all of the rules that basically any designer needs to know to make text look good, to be laid out well, to be readable, all those things. So it's not that I'm bad at typography in general, it's that I know that there are people who put so much effort into typography. And not even just printed typography. There are people who put a lot of effort into typography on the web. And it's the sorts of sites you see featured on TypeWolf, which is as in type typography and wolf as in the animal, in case anyone wants to look it up. But the person who runs that website is really focused on typography. And so they're collecting examples of websites where the designers of those websites were also really focused on typography. And I don't think I'd ever put enough effort in to get to that point. I usually keep it simple, and maybe I'll go for a combination of serif and sans serif, you know, just for a bit of variety. But it's not much beyond that, you know. Most of my typography knowledge is focused on layout, sizing, you know, scaling and things.
Yeah.
So there's such a large ceiling, such a high and subtle ceiling, I should say, on typography that I haven't explored because you can put so much time into comparing two almost identical sans serifs. And have, you know, seemingly valid opinions about which one is better and why, even though if you showed it to the person on the street, as long as they're not a typographer, they wouldn't be able to tell, you know, the difference.
I think it's like, you're right, it's one of those areas that you could just go super deep on, even to the point where you decide to make your own font and like learn how to do that, which sounds, I almost said fun, but I don't know that it sounds fun. It sounds really hard and interesting.
Engaging.
It sounds challenging, but as someone who studied graphic design, I do kind of understand the like staring at two different sans serif fonts and like, well, this one has the kind of A that I like, and this has the kind of, I don't know, K, because my name is Katie, so I always look at K's. These kinds of things are more important in graphic design, I think, than they are in web design, for me at least. But I still tend to stick with the same fonts for everything, because I guess that's a strategy that you have, is that you've like done the work to find the things that work, the combinations that work for you, and then you just kind of stick with those or stick with the same sizing throughout.
Yeah, and I think they fit 99% of situations.
Yeah.
People used to talk about the famous graphic designer who wrote a book. I really enjoyed the book as well. It's a shame that I can't remember his name. He was famous for only having 5 typefaces that he used. Mm. Do you know who I'm talking about?
No.
Yeah, I'm going to remember his name about 10 minutes from now, and then I'll just blurt it out while you're saying something.
That's fine.
There's a graphic designer who's famous for only using 5 typefaces throughout his entire career. And he was, world-class graphic designer. So everyone who's followed any graphic designers will probably have heard of him and is probably screaming it at their iPod right now.
Their iPod.
But yeah. I was thinking of podcasts, you know, the origin of the name. But so that person was a famous graphic designer, and they chose to limit themselves to that set of 5 typefaces. And so that was seen as quite a daring and like bold thing to do. But I think actually, especially in interface design, almost every designer on the planet is doing exactly the same thing, where they keep it to, inter is the commonly joked about everything typeface for interface design. For good reason, I'm sure. But it feels like everyone can do that. And it's the real difference I see between myself and other people who are much more into typography is people who like go and collect typefaces.
I was going to ask if you
really
do that.
Into it. Yeah, like they go and like look at all of the, you know, the foundries, and they find their favorite ones, and they've got a favorite typeface that's not web safe or whatever. It's just, I don't know if web safe is still a valid term now with web fonts. But I just stick to things that are available on Google Fonts, because I think Google Fonts knows that if you make typefaces more easily available, they'll get used.
Yeah.
And it's you have to put a lot of commitment in to go and like find these non-freely available typefaces.
Okay, I do that. So I'm definitely a little bit more into it than you are. And I also collect them, but I don't use them. I just download them and they go somewhere, and I never think about them again. So
this is my suspicion, yeah. about all those people who talk about collecting typefaces, I assume they never have a chance to use them, even though they are excited.
Yeah.
Having said that, I did, if I need like a custom typeface, which I have done 2 or 3 times in my career for personal stuff, I've basically gone to one of the respected modern typeface foundries and just looked for one that I liked, like that was the right type, you know, their best sans serif or something. And so I think you can even take it that far, and it's still quite practical, where you just find a good foundry and stick with their work, because they're going to be making good typefaces, especially if it's their more popular, less quirky ones.
I do that as well. Okay. So last one for me. Iterating before perfecting. And this kind of is related to form over function, I guess. And maybe depends on the kind of medium that I'm working in. But I have a hard time iterating, I guess, on things. Like in Figma, honestly, like I had one of my coworkers a couple years ago, we were pair designing in Figma, and he would just like make 70 art boards, just keep copying and like making small tweaks. And I was like, oh, okay. I think that's kind of what I should be doing, more so than just going deep on one thing and getting it perfect before you're showing someone. So I try to do that more, but you can kind of go a little wild on that. You have to kind of like stop at some point. This is a little bit all over the place. I guess it's like being willing to iterate a lot more, and also showing people your work that is not at all finished and asking for feedback is a little bit uncomfortable for me, because I don't want the wrong kind of feedback, and I don't know what people are going to focus on if it's like not even at all close to where I want it to be. And so I tend to sort of like button things up a lot before I really show them. Same with code as well. I probably will. I think iterating is harder with code because you're not like in an artboard. You're sort of just building something. And so that is one benefit of working in Figma, I guess, is it's a little bit easier to iterate.
Yeah, they say something like vectors are free. I think there's a saying about this where they're encouraging people to always duplicate and then make the next change on the duplicate rather than, which is good advice. Yeah, I think it's easy to forget that and think I don't need the old versions, but you might want to go back and check something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason not to. And so you're saying that you are bad at iterating enough before you try to whittle it down to the right.
I think so. Like sometimes I just want to jump in and build it. And maybe I will, like I said, I think it's harder to iterate in code. And so you probably won't. You will polish whatever you decided to build. You won't iterate anymore. So that's where I think I should slow down basically a little bit, depending on what it is that I'm working on, and focus on iterating.
Yeah, I can imagine that if you're the person that can or will code the thing that you're designing, then there's always that sort of draw into coding instead of, you know, moving vectors around.
Yeah.
And I feel it myself. If I'm going to build a website for myself, like my personal website, for example, I basically don't design in Figma almost ever. But at work, where I'm handing off to someone, I want to hand them, you know, the best version of whatever it is that I can. So I iterate in Figma a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
But I also want to see it in code so I can iterate on it based on that, because there's the reality comes crashing down and, you know, you can't iterate for too long. But that's probably a different point than when you're making.
It's also faster. It's like, to me, it's exhausting to be building something in Figma that just feels so slow compared to using CSS for that. But slow is okay sometimes, is what I'm saying. It's okay to slow down.
Well, I guess it's also that in CSS, you're probably used to giving these classes, and then you can change one number almost by default, and it updates all of the instances of that thing.
Yes,
but, in Figma, you have to do a lot more work to set up components and then pull those components
variables
in. And so I never do that thing, and it starts to get annoying, you know, holding down command click and like selecting multiple things, of like multiple headlines and then changing. So it does get annoying because I don't think they've properly figured out the sort of component approach for those early explorations. It feels like components are there and they've been designed for design systems, whereas actually I want a way to say, mark all these in the same way, and when I change this number, it'll change all of them. It doesn't feel like building a component first is the right way to do that. It feels like now I know what I've got, what I'm working with, I can select them all and then sort of make them all a trial to this one or something, you know?
Yeah, I think you're right.
So that would be nice. But yeah, iterating, extremely important. It took me a while to realize that you need to iterate at least 15 times on something to make it look good. And that number sounds arbitrary, and it sort of is, but I kept realizing that when I saw examples of how people iterated, there was at least 15 almost every time.
Okay.
Yeah, so there's this like sort of general rule, it seems like, but it's a very loose rule, where if you're iterating 5 times, unless it's extremely simple, it's probably not where it could be yet. And I'm also bad at iterating in the sense that if I try to do it myself, I usually run out of steam. I sort of get into a mental alleyway, dead end. Alleyways are fine because they keep going, but yeah, dead end alleyway. And I found that you can often need to get some energy, mental energy, from someone else or outside force that helps you to go back to it and keep going. And so I can iterate forever as long as I've got like a little bit of a push from something or someone.
Yep.
Every once in a while.
I agree with that too.
Otherwise, yeah, I definitely run out of steam. I got
one more
too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so this one was color, and then I changed it to color palettes because actually I think I'm okay with color. I've learned a lot of the rules that you can use, but color is so personal, subjective, and there's so much variety just in the color wheel alone. You know, 360 different hues if you're just going by, you know, HSL in CSS. You've got 360 values for the colors, and then you've got all the brightness and luminosity. No, saturation and luminosity. Yeah. So, or luminance, maybe, that they use some weird words that you think are one word and actually are another. when they start getting technical. But I think I'm fine picking colors, but once it gets into 2, 3, 4 colors, that's when I start to think, why am I even doing this? Let's just keep it simple and have black, white, and like one or two primary looking accent colors. And I think it's because you can spend a long time tweaking color palettes, even if it's not for a design system, if it's just for a one-off. If you wanted to use, you know, 4 different shades of 4 different colors to make a website like really stand out with color, that's extremely hard. And I think there are people who get very practiced at it, and I assume they've got some sort of practical ways they approach it, but they don't tell anyone because it's better if it looks a bit more, you know, fluffy. Like maybe they always start with like these brightness values and then just find hues that fit or something. Or maybe they always start with someone else's palette and like tweak it a little bit so it looks sufficiently different. Because it's hard for me to imagine with how bad I am at it that someone is sitting down and creating a, let's say, 5 color palette from scratch that works well, unless they're spending a long time. I think I could eventually get there if I took, you know, a couple of days at it. But if they're just pumping out really good looking and well working color palettes with a lot of colors in them, then I'm in awe.
Yeah, I think this is one where there's just so many good color palettes out there that already exist. It's easy enough to just use those and like pick the colors from it that you need for your, if you don't need the entire palette. I rarely start from scratch. I think I've pretty much always used tools where you just pick, you could pick like one color you really like and then create a palette around that. Like Adobe used to have that tool. Maybe they still have it, called Adobe Color, or I think it, I don't know, Cooler. It used to have like a weird name, and it would like create, you would just like pick one color you like, and then it would like create little, it would create complementary or the other ones, the other words that I can't think of.
Triadic. Quadratic is that one. And then
analogous.
Complementary is what this podcast is named. It's good that you knew that one.
It's good. Yeah.
It sounds like you're talking partly about color palettes that you'd see in a design system, which is, let's say, 10 different hues or 8 different hues or whatever, and they've all got color stops, you know, brightness stops. And so what I'm more talking about is the application of those palettes. So how do you pick 4 or 5 colors for a one-off instance of a website or, you know, something else? Even just like a, you know, something you're going to print, you know, like a pamphlet. Picking colors that work together without keeping it simple is like the really hard part, where maybe the background is a color, not just white or black, and maybe the foreground is also a color, but it's a different hue from the background, you know. There are ways you can make it more complicated, and I've never really understood how someone lands on that without just a lot of tweaking until something feels right, and then using that as a base and then tweaking more until something feels right elsewhere. And maybe that's how they do it, you know, maybe they're just not talking about it much.
I think it's totally different for print design. Print design is more like, how is this actually going to print? And then so you do like probably have some favorite Pantone colors, for example, or you're just literally tweaking it and doing print checks to see how it's actually going to look. But I feel like with graphic design, you are just opening the color picker and like gradually shifting things around, which feels different from what we do on web design now, which is like a bit more, these are the options that I have, and then I can use a range of that. It's less like fluid.
It's a lot more systematic.
Yeah.
I think the closest we get, because actually a lot of interface design situations use quite simple color approaches. Even a website that's for marketing, you know, you might have a solid background color and maybe it changes, but it'll be one of 2 background colors for different sections and so on.
Yeah.
It feels like the closest we get to that sort of, this color palette has to work together harmoniously, is the sort of mesh gradients people put together. And they're less popular now, but back, you know, let's say 3 years ago, mesh gradients were all the rage, and you had to pick colors that worked together and blended together and didn't cross over into gray when they sort of transition from one to another.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of variables to tweak there, where you can like choose 4 or 5 different colors in the gradient and then choose brightnesses and choose position and how they, you know. So that sort of thing maybe feels like the closest you get to choosing 4 or 5 colors that have to work together closely.
Yeah. That's another thing I'm not good at, because I think that's similar to animation. It's like you could get really good at these gradients that you need for like one specific tiny thing. And I think some people are really good at figuring those out. And to me, I'm just like, they all look nice. They all look exciting. I don't really know what is making this one look better than this other one. They all seem interesting. So yeah.
One of the things I enjoyed most was a post I saw, this is a couple of years ago now. It was a person who was talking about how important animation was to their career. I think they were positioning it as how important animation is to your career. Like they were positioning it as career advice. You know, animation is going to become more important. But then you look at their bio and they're an animation designer, right? So they basically go into companies that really need animation, like Airbnb probably has a lot of animation needs. Netflix probably has a lot of animation needs. And they're designing animation all day. And so, of course, they're going to believe that animation, like really high-end animation, is important. But I like to believe that, like I said earlier, 99% of designers can get away with not basic knowledge, but like foundational knowledge.
Yeah.
And maybe in the odd occasion, you need to enhance that a bit with a bit more knowledge. Like if you really want to focus on the easing curves and you've never touched them before.
Yeah.
Maybe if there's a lot of movement, you'll see how smooth it is a bit more easily. And so that needs a bit more thoughtfulness.
Hmm.
But again, that could just be me coping.
I think it's just going to depend on, there's so many different variables that impact it. Sometimes it's best to leave it to the experts, and it's a good opportunity. Like, I think it's okay to just respect that some people are experts in a thing. And if you have the means to hire experts for things, that's awesome. You should do that and you can learn from them. Cool. Okay. Well, we got through all of the things that we're not good at. Not too hard to talk about it. It's good to talk about things you're not good at, I think.
You said we got through all of the things that we're not good at. You mean that we wrote down, I assume.
Yes, that's it. Nothing else.
There's plenty more. Yeah, I had to rack my brains for these three.
Oof, yeah, it was really hard to think of these.
It's not like there's 18 more that I could have written down easily.
We did say we might follow up with a future episode of things we are good at, the opposite of this. So that'll be fun to think about. Obviously very easy for us to come up with those things.
Well, it's important to be aware of your drawbacks.
Yeah.
Drawback feels wrong for a person. Your
shortcomings.
That also feels, yeah. The things you are bad at and the things you are good at.
Yeah.
In both directions. So
Yeah,
hopefully it will be easy. Otherwise, we should take a long, hard look at ourselves in the mirror and be kinder.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for us today. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Hopefully you can relate to some of these things. I'm sure you can. And we'll catch you in the next one.